few nights ago, I was at home. It's the time when you get really tired and you're thinking about going to sleep, and my phone made that warbling noise that lets me know that I've received a message. At first, I was grumpy. Who was taking me at this late hour? But when I looked at the message, my annoyance was replaced with wonder. I did not recognize the picture of the woman or the last name of the sender, but her other names and the question she asked raised in me a surge of unexpected delight. Anne Barrett, who had been my best friend at summer camp in Appalachia and whom I had not seen or spoken with in 30 years. I still have no idea how she managed to find me. I was caught up in a flood of memories, laughing in our cabin, walking to dinner arm in arm, skinny dipping by the riflery range, floating candles on the river, writing letters back and forth from college, her innocent handwriting telling me she found a great boyfriend and was hoping for a ring. And then on my screen, the question, what are you up to? Yeah, you all get it, right? What was I up to? How could I describe 30 years of life in a stupid text message? What were the words that would show this intimate stranger who I was and what kind of woman I'd become? What would you have written? Think about it. If you had to tell someone who you are in 25 words, or even 100, what would you say? Anyone want to volunteer?
I would say, I'm funny and happy to be on the way to the floor.
Okay, that's not a bad opening, yes.
Call me,
right? It is so hard to give a stranger any real sense of your humanity. Perhaps that's why Jesus so often turned to story, because the lived, breathed texture of our lives, which we can give in conversation, but not really in text message, indicates much more clearly who we are and whose than any array of words, no matter how carefully chosen. Our identities are complex. They're mixtures of our experiences, our biology, our choices, and of the ideas and people we've encountered on the way. In today's reading, identity seems particularly slippery and hard to grasp. Tabitha, we're told, is also Dorcas, because both words mean gazelle. Names don't work like that. My name means honeybee, but if one of you calls out, "Hey, honeybee," I'm not likely to recognize that you're trying to speak to me. Although I feel like I've just set myself up for the next several months. And yet somehow Tabitha is also Dorcas, probably because the people who were reading Luke's words were more likely to know Greek than to know Aramaic. So Luke changes her name in order to make her intelligible to people who've never met her. Later, St. John sees in a vision a great multitude, and an elder asks him, "Who are these? And where do they come from?" And when John replies that he does not know, the elder explains, "These are they who have come out of the great ordeal. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." That doesn't tell us who they are, merely that they are related to Jesus. Jesus and John himself could observe more detail than that. He tells us that the multitude came from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. But in this story, that's not the thing that matters. To the elder, what matters is their connection to Christ. Even Jesus seems strangely opaque. When the Jews come to him and ask, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us plainly," all Jesus says is, "I have told you. You don't believe." In all these stories, we are up against the limits of our preconceptions. The Jews cannot reconcile this man Jesus with their understanding of who the Messiah was supposed to be. Luke's Greek-speaking readers need help to understand a Hebrew woman's life. St. John cannot find words to describe a crowd of people who are visibly dissimilar, yet who share a common purpose. It's the same problem that dogs us all the time. How do we live in a pluralistic and multicultural society, honoring our own identity without denigrating the identities of others? How do we speak of people without labeling them in inadequate ways? How do we describe the members of a church that is meant to include everyone? How do we speak of ourselves without invoking categories that Christ has made irrelevant? 2 years ago, the vestry of this church voted unanimously to embrace the multicultural identity. It felt like a radical act, but that's only a reflection of our context. The truth is that the Church of Christ has always been multicultural. Ancient Rome was the most diverse polyglot society the world had ever known. Walking down the streets of even a backwater like Judea, it would not have been surprising to see tall men with yellow or red hair from Northern Europe, to hear languages from Africa and the Mediterranean, to buy silk from Persia, or silver from Britain, or slave girls from Turkey or Namibia, to see Arabs and Greeks and people who worshipped Mithras and Isis and Zeus. The question for the church is not how to become multicultural. The question is how, after the fall of Rome, we allowed ourselves to become narrow. Well, history intervened, and we did. While the church as a whole remained international after the breakup of Rome, the diversity of countries and towns decreased until parishes were largely homogeneous. And so the issue with which we wrestle here in the 21st century is how to recapture what we have always been, a great multitude, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. And our three stories today, opaque though they are, all gesture in the same direction. When the Christians in Joppa summoned Peter and wished to show him who Tabitha was, they do not resort to words. Instead, they hold up the garment she's made for the poor. They allow her to define her life, not through outward marks of identity, but through her deeds. See this tunic? It is the image of her soul. What a loving soul. This scene seemed strange to me until I met a certain woman in Alabama. There was in our church a ministry of women who would gather each week to knit or crochet miniature caps and booties and blankets for the premature babies who were born at the local charity hospital. Among them, there was one who dedicated herself to sewing tiny, perfect linen burial clothes, sized for babies who weighed less than 3 pounds. I could barely bring myself to look at them. They spoke so palpably of loss. She told me that she had lost her own child. This was her way of reaching out from her own pain to begin to ease the pain of others. See this tunic? It's the image of her soul. See what a tender one it is. Jesus, too, appeals beyond the confines of words. When the Jews will not understand who he is, he says, "The works that I do in my Father's name testify to me." And St. John's great multitude are described not by their markers of external identity, but by the fact that they chose to be baptized into Christ. Some deeds speak more clearly than words. They show us who we really are. The author of Colossians sums it up in these words: "Here there cannot be Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free man, But Christ is all and in all. Christ is all and in all. Think about that. What if every person we meet were simply to be recognized as Christ because Christ is in them? How would that rock our world? That's the promise underneath the second focus area in our strategic plan, the integration of the Spanish-speaking and English-speaking members of our parish through shared engagement in service, worship, pastoral care, and education. Notice that by using language groups there, we're skipping over, or choosing not to focus on, other kinds of differences that are in this congregation. We have people from lots of parts of the world here, and Americans from lots of different ethnic and cultural traditions. But the idea is not simply to learn about one another or to appreciate one another's heritage, although those are necessary. It's to share our lives with one another, so that at the last, when our friends hold up for us the evidence of what we've done with our lives, we will find out that we were inextricable from one another. There will be the meals that we cooked and ate together, and the ones that we prepared for the homeless, the flowers we arranged, the children that we taught together, the homes that we repaired in Appalachia. There will no longer be us and them, but only we. We who love one another. Jean Vanier writes, "To become a good shepherd is to be attentive to those for whom we are responsible, so as to reveal to them their fundamental beauty and value, and help them grow and become fully alive." That's what Christ does for us. He shows us the beauty of our souls, which most of us barely dare to claim. The first time we taught the core curriculum, we were speaking of our souls, and one man said, "I can believe that my soul is a thing of shining beauty, but I cannot believe that I am really my soul." Our work in this life is to erase that disbelief for one another, to evoke that beauty in one another, to show everyone we meet not the image of Christ in ourselves, but the image of Christ in them. A couple years after I was ordained, I took a group on a mission trip to Bolivia. One day, having a few spare hours, three of us hiked out of our remote mountain village into the Andes around us. After a while, I came to a stream. On the other side was a tiny girl, not more than 4 or 5 years old, holding in her arms a newborn lamb. I was an utter stranger, different to her, different from her family in race and in dress. I did not speak her language. I could easily have overpowered her. But she crossed the stream to where I stood and smiled up at me. And then she put the lamb down at my feet and gestured for me to touch it. It was an act of utter trust to take the best thing she had and share it with a passing stranger. To assume that what delighted her would delight me, that I would be gentle and kind and loving, that I could be those things. I do not know her name, and I cannot speak her language, but I've never forgotten her. Looking at what she did, I could see the beauty of her soul, and for a moment, there was one thought. One shepherd.